Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast in our Superintendent Series. This episode is brought to you by Toro. For more than a century, with cutting-edge turf equipment and irrigation solutions, Toro has had your front nine covered and your back nine too. In fact, Toro's always had your back, period. Toro is as committed to your long-term success as tour pros are committed to their shot. That's down to top-notch customer service from Toro and its dedicated local distributors, both of whom are passionate about delivering turf equipment and irrigation solutions that solve real-world problems. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor today. Today's episode is with Aaron McMaster, superintendent at Orchard Lake Country Club outside of Detroit.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie. I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Did that help you as a superintendent playing every once in a while?
100%. I mean, I used to play a lot, you know, back when I was 30, 35, 40, and you could tolerate actually practicing and playing, you know, once, twice a week. So, and I was good, not an old hag like I am now, but I think it's a must. I think if you can't play the game, you don't understand how people think when they're out on the golf course, not really sure how you maintain their turf. You know, so it's definitely a key. I don't think you have to be good. You just gotta understand the game and maybe why somebody might be complaining to you that the approach is soft and the greens are firm or vice versa, something like that. If you don't play, it's tough to understand that.
Can you ever think of a situation where you had played and you saw something and then you changed it the way you guys maintain it?
Not like immediately, because it's pretty difficult to change something other than, you know, maybe you went out and you played and you had a few bunkers that you weren't happy with, you know, the quality that would change quickly, but it's more based off of a season long, like we didn't like how this played this season and, you know, let's start to work on some things to change that. So now if you have some small things that maybe irrigation wise you could change quickly to firm something up or something that you didn't recognize right away, yeah, that can happen. But I feel like most of it is based off of a season long, you know, evaluation of your golf course and then how your membership changes, right? Like since we've renovated, our membership has changed, you know, quite a bit. We have a lot, what I would say is maybe more players and they obviously want it firmer and faster. And so, you know, you can't do that overnight. I mean, you can't just go in and turn the water off. You'll have a lot of dead grass. So you got to work, you know, your turf and stuff so that you can give them that kind of condition. But it's definitely drastically different than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, I guess I never thought about that. It's that it's not like you can just go out and buy a new rug and change the way your golf course looks. Like it takes a lot of time to make a big change on a golf course. It's a long-term project for almost all of the changes rather than a short-term fix.
No question. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's a living system. And if you try to do anything too radical to it, you can cause a lot of problems, a lot of headaches. So, you know, you're sort of, you know, dancing with the partner that you got when you get to like June for us in this area, and you're kind of stuck in that until you get to maybe like September and you can start doing more work on the way you want, you know, your sward of turf to perform. Those are the times that you can really get after it.
When you get to July, you're at a place where you're kind of, because of the weather, you're just kind of stuck with, you know, this is the way it's going to be for a while, right?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, you can really try to make some wholesale changes with cultural practices in, for us, typically late March to early May. And then you're sort of set up for a while. You really don't want to go out and punch holes in the ground or over sand or things like that when it's, 85, 90 degrees outside. You just kind of, at that point, you're just managing your system to get you through those stressful months. And then you can get back after it again in the fall, September and October, and try to, you know, get towards those goals of whatever your membership's, you know, expectations are. And that's really what drives us here. It's not necessarily, you know, my two cents. I mean, we have 300 people here, and you got to try to balance across that spectrum, right? Like what's firm enough for the good golfers, but not too firm for kind of your higher handicaps or, you know, seniors, women, things like that. So, you know, at a place like this where we have a diverse amount of players, it's definitely a balancing act.
You've been here for a while.
22 years.
Is it so Orchard Lake, and you've been, you know, obviously through a big renovation, but in terms of being here for 22 years, how have you changed in terms of your working with committees like you just talked about, where it's not my decision necessarily, but you obviously have a lot of input, but how has, would you say over the years, your approach to working with memberships changed?
That is a good question. I would say, you know, I mean, I was like 30 when I got the superintendent's job here. So, you know, you think you know a lot, you don't know a lot. You're just, you know, I mean, just hair on fire. Hey, I'm going to, you know, just absolutely blow up the world, right? But I was fortunate. I had a really good greens chairman for my first 4 years here. And, you know, we kind of sat down and had like concept for what we thought the first like 4 or 5 years would go like, because you really can't do these things like in just a short period of time. Like there's got to be a longer vision. And that's where I feel like the committee as a whole, that should really be most of their job, is what's our vision. You know, my job is to try to produce that on a day-to-day basis, that, you know, the conditions play the way that they want. You can't have someone down here asking me if I, you know, rolled the greens today. You know, it's more they're there to look at, you know, a broader vision of where we're going and, you know, what our results are too, obviously. I mean, we get evaluated, but, I would say I've gotten a little better at, you know, handling the politics. I think probably all young superintendents at some point, you know, put their foot in their mouth, say something you shouldn't, maybe push the envelope a little too far, things like that. So I've kind of gotten better at just, you know, navigating all that. And you know, obviously we have a way that we want to see the turf, you know, be able to be maintained, which requires budgets and capital expenditures and things like that. And that's probably like the biggest difference of what I have a much better handle on now than I did, you know, when I was 30 years old.
Mm-hmm. So when you came here, it was before you guys did the Keith Foster renovation, restoration. I never know what to call them, but
nobody does anymore.
Right? I know. It's blurred lines. But talk about, you know, what that project, and obviously, you know, huge transformation of the club, and as you mentioned earlier, the culture. But talk about going through that process from the beginning to the end, and just the value of being here and having, you know, a relationship with the club before you started that project.
So I took over in 2001, and the club had just renovated all the bunkers in 1996 with Art Hills. And there were some things that the club didn't necessarily like about the way those bunkers had played. A lot of balls would roll up to the edges of the grass and things like that. So when we took over, we decided to look for a new architect, and we settled, the committee interviewed, I think it was about 5 people, settled on Keith Foster. Way too long ago now for me to even tell you, you know, why we settled on him, but it was, I do remember that everyone unanimously was like, this is the guy. It helped that I had been here, you know, a little while before that, to kind of explain to him, you know, here's what their issues are with the golf course, instead of just me coming in, an architect coming in right away, and you don't really have a good feel for the membership and what, you know, what are they trying to get done. I think that that's a tough you know, situation for a superintendent and an architect to get put into is somebody just comes up one day and says, hey, we want to do a renovation. We're hiring a new architect. We're hiring a new golf course superintendent. And there's no history there. They don't really understand the membership. And they just go in and tear the place up. And it doesn't necessarily result in the membership being as happy as you probably could be with a renovation.
Well, in a lot of ways, you're in the renovation process, you're kind of a bridge and you spend the most time with an architect when they're out here. So you're kind of a bridge and an extension of the membership, and you know what they want, right?
Yeah, you hope you do. So I would say, you know, between, you know, myself and you know, you hope that you have a golf pro that has a good history of the membership that can also, you know, bridge that for you. You know, with us, we just knew what some of the issues were that we had to get rectified. So Keith came in 02. We did a master plan with him, and it really just involved doing the bunkers. There was going to be maybe a couple of tee placement changes and things like that, but for the most part, it was really just to renovate the bunkers. We didn't get that. In 02, they had a few other projects going on at the club, so we never actually made it to a club-wide vote. So it kind of got tabled for a little while. We brought it back up again in 2007 and actually did get it to a vote. Financial collapse, calamity, whatever you want to call it, all, you know, transcended on us and was probably even worse in the Detroit area than a lot of other areas. And we narrowly missed. So then it really got kind of shelved, just put on the back burner for a little while. You know, you're just really trying to take care of the grass and things like that. And then in 2011, we decided to bring it back up. And fortunately, a membership was on board, even though it was still, you know, a little risky financially from a economic standpoint in the Detroit area. But we did benefit from some good pricing on that, and it did pass. And we did the renovation in 2012. The benefit of that whole thing was being in contact with Keith constantly, us implementing some of the things, which was, I would say, 80% tree removal, some mowing line adjustments, things like that. We started to get a little bit different vision of what we thought the long view of the club should be. So had we renovated in 02 or even 07, the golf course would not look anything like what it does right now.
How do you think it would have been different had you done it in 02 or 07 versus doing it in 2012?
I don't feel like certainly in 02, tree removal was still, you know, highly controversial. By the time we hit 07, we were really only removing enough trees to grow good bent grass. So still not enough to really impact the architectural, you know, look of the golf course. But by the time we reached 2011, when we were going to vote again, there were, you know, mass improvements in memberships, you know, taking out a lot of trees and adding in some fescues. You know, we call them low maintenance areas, but I mean, trust me, there's nothing really low maintenance about them. But
that's something I want to talk about later, because I think that's a misconception.
Complete misconception. Yeah. So but it was, you know, and we were looking at it from the standpoint of, it was going to be more sustainable. We would be using less water, less pesticides, less fertilizer than if it were big green grass areas. And then, you know, it adds an enhancement with the color. You know, our golf course was basically just a big green, you know, patch across the whole 120 acres. And now we have some really great contrast. And I just think it was becoming more acceptable. It was still a hard sell, trust me. I mean, we had some people who looked at the plan, and when they saw that amount of trees gone, and whatnot, I mean, they were radically against it. So
how many trees did you guys take down roughly? I don't know if you want to give a number, but I know, having seen before, it was substantial. And I mean, I think, do you think a lot of members didn't know what was under the trees in terms of the scale and the unbelievable movement of this property?
There's no question that the trees blocked the majority of the property. A lot of the trees that were planted over the years were maples, in particular Norway maples. So they're low to the ground, rooty, can't grow any grass underneath them. I mean, it's a should just be banned as a golf course tree, right? I mean, it's
I've
just
got
a terrible
one in my
tree.
Front yard. It yeah. drives me insane.
Yeah. And you probably would call me and say, well, how do I grow grass under here? And, you know, I'd say basil pruning. That's how you'd grow grass underneath there. But it really, due to that style of a tree, right? You know, they blocked all the property over the years. And as we slowly started taking some of that out, even in 02, 03, 04, you know, people were starting to see it. So it was definitely a radical change for the 2012 renovation, but I feel like a large percent of the membership kind of saw the land starting to come out due to the selective tree removal we had already done. All total, I'd say we're probably somewhere, you know, give or take 100, near 1,000 mm-hmm. removal. Yeah.
In terms of, did you feel like, you know, obviously it's always a very hot topic at a golf course was tree removal, and I'm sure it was the same way here. Was there a momentum that built with almost like every, you know, substantial tree run of tree removal done in like a winter, or, you know, I assume a lot of trees people don't even notice are gone. When did the perception start to change?
Not until we reopened. Yeah. Matter of fact, the brutal aspect of our renovation, and I tell guys who call me all the time, you would never do a renovation the way we did a renovation, but we had no choice. It was the only way it was going to get passed and done. So we literally came in and did 80% of the tree removal in January and February. And then we had like the greatest March ever. I mean, it was like 75 to 80 degrees. So nice. We were letting carts out. We had golf going on everywhere. And I've got like 700, you know, dirt patches all over the place, some of which were going to become like a bunker or native. And it just looked like a war zone. And we went from March all the way until August 1st when we closed looking like that.
What were members saying?
I think I've blocked it all out. I know there were some rough comments for sure. I'm pretty sure at one point, I think we actually got a letter saying that they wished that they could halt the destruction and so on and so forth. So, I mean, you know, I always look at it as they do what they do for a living, right? Like they're doctors, lawyers, you know, businessmen, businesswomen, whatever they do, they're not golf course architects or golf course superintendents or golf pros for that matter. Right. And so it can be hard for them to maybe have that vision of what the end result's going to look like. And unlike say painting your house, right, where you know, guys just show up one day and they paint it and, you know, 48 hours later, you're like, wow, this looks great. You know, for us, this takes like, you know, 4 or 5 months. So it's, you know, requires a lot of patience on their part. And as much as we would try to explain, it's just hard until you actually see the product on the ground. So once we did get rolling though, and we had about 4 or 5 holes done, we even some of the members who were highly critical early on said, love it. Awesome.
So you get the trees out, then you do the bunker restoration. And did you guys do anything with grasses also?
We did. We methyl bromided 17 of the 18 greens. The 15th green, we had a little backstep. We had 5 greens that were rebuilt here in the 60s. And those 5 greens were built out of a 2NS sand, just a really tough environment once you started top dressing with finer sands over the top of them to grow, you know, good quality turf grass on. So I did feel like we had done enough stuff to 4 of them.
So why is that? I'm just curious.
Why is that a tough environment?
Yeah.
Because as soon as you put finer sands over top of coarser sands, it's just a bathtub. They just hold water up in the top and you can't get it to move through.
Because the higher sands percolate faster than the sand underneath it. Is that
no? In that scenario, when they first built the green, the 2NS sand would perk really fast.
Okay.
You would never use that sand for a green now. No chance.
Okay.
But it was like 1962, 63, 64. Right. It was probably, you know, whatever was the cheapest sand. You know, that's, I'm sure there was some philosophy to that, right? Hey, it's sand, just get it, throw it on there. So, but it's like, to you, it would literally look like rocks almost. And as soon as we hit the era of top dressing, you obviously can't top dress with that stuff. So we, not we, but the club was using a finer sand to put on the greens for regular top dressing. And as soon as you do that, you perch the water table. So now as you build up that sand over the 2NS, that's where all the water is going to stay. And so those greens were a struggle. They had moss on them and, you know, they just didn't, they didn't play that great. But we had been able to do some things to four of them that were acceptable to put turf on, new bentgrass turf. And we had put internal drainage in them, a lot of deep tine aeration to break through that layer. So they actually were draining fairly well. The 15th green, however, no matter what we did to it, we just couldn't get that one to the specs that we knew we'd need for bentgrass. So we completely rebuilt that green. So we have one totally new green. And 17 were methyl bromided, all regrassed. The approaches were regrassed. The fairways were regrassed. Really, the only thing we didn't get to do was much rough. If it wasn't sodded, we didn't actually have the time because of our small window to kill a lot of rough and reseed it to a quality bluegrass. So we're kind of doing that now with just some tenacity sprays and overseeding. And our rough's gotten a lot better in the last like 4 or 5 years. So.
So you spray it and then you overseed it in like the spring or fall, and
rough,
yeah,
fall. Yeah. Yeah, we'll do some overseeding again in areas that maybe didn't take so well in the fall. So if we felt like a spot didn't come in as thick as we wanted it, we'll go out, punch some holes in it, and throw some more seed in there to thicken it up. But it's really been a huge improvement. We had a lot of bent grass and poa in our roughs, and when you hit late July into August, it gets dollar spot, and it's got that, you know, from a play standpoint, it almost mimics like Kikuyu or Bermuda, and it's just gnarly to hit out of when you're mowing bent grass at 2.5 inches. It's just a terrible playing surface.
It's the worst way, yeah, to get, especially around the greens.
If it's around the greens, it's horrible.
You just have no clue how to hit a shot.
None. I mean, it's just an awful, awful scenario for chipping out of, for sure. So. Yeah.
I think the best way is to close down the face and just to like know that it's going to come out hot that way, because you know it's coming out that way. If you try and hit anything else, I feel like it'll just eat you alive.
Oh, 100%. 100%. I do feel like, you know, guys who carry like the 60-degree wedge, you don't really have to open the face, right? I mean, you just kind of lay it down square, make a reasonably decent swing, and I mean, the ball almost hits you in the forehead. It's going so straight up. And, you know, there's no point in opening the face. Like, I didn't grow up playing golf that way, right? Like, I grew up playing golf where you had two wedges. Mm-hmm. You got a 52 and a 56. And if you needed to change it, you know, you manipulated the thing, right? Like, now you talk to these guys and it's like, oh, yeah, I got a wedge for 82 yards. I got a wedge for 91 yards. And then all you do is just watch them chunk it all over the place anyway. And it just, I don't know. There's some aspects of the game that I think some of this stuff has been good for, and then there's other aspects that it's like let's just get rid of it.
This golf course is an interesting example because of the green locations and the scale, where it's a bigger scale, and if you miss around the greens, you have a lot of times a big uphill shot to the green, where that 60-degree is such a huge advantage around a course like this, where, you know, you're having it, that loft is such an advantage versus a 56-degree. Loft ban would be an interesting one, because you think about how big of a revolution just the sand wedge was back in the day.
1,000%. I mean, it's certainly changed like our job, because now if you don't have almost concrete bricks for greens, like, these guys can stop the ball virtually anywhere. I mean, you know, I don't know what they go up to now, honestly, but I think you can get like a 63 or 64 degree wedge. It's like, it's crazy. You know, I mean, you can almost hit it just straight up in the air with no spin, and that ball just comes out on a green side chip that it's like dead. Even if the green's 13 and, you know, it's super firm, like, these guys can still, you know, play that shot around the green. So there's no question that that's, you know, what's changed the most since I've been here, right? Like, I mean, 10.5 and reasonably dry greens used to challenge the heck out of even the best players. And that's not the case anymore.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor, Toro. Two things tour pros hate: leaking oil down the stretch and their caddy having to quiet spectators. Golf course maintenance pros are the same, except they worry about literally leaking hydraulic oil and waking up the neighbors with early morning mowing routines. Toro's new Greensmaster E-TriFlex Series riding greens mower solved both problems. The engine generator model is amazingly quiet in operation, while the lithium-ion battery model is virtually silent. Both E-TriFlex models carry no hydraulic fluid on board, using all electric components for traction, steering, lift, and cutting. This means not only are potential leaks a thing of the past, but noise complaints are too. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo. Now back to Aaron McMaster.
You guys were one of the first courses in Detroit to do like a big restoration. And I'm curious, with all these other a lot of other courses have followed suit since. I'm sure superintendents in the area call you and ask you questions about stuff you guys did, and obviously you've been around here for a while. I'm curious if when superintendents call you, what's some of your advice for restoration renovations if their club or course is looking into it? What do you typically tell them?
So you are correct. For the first few years afterward, we did field a lot of calls. I would say most of my conversations revolved around what not to do versus what to do. You know, certainly I would never do a renovation now and not rebuild all the greens, but we had no shot at that. That would be like first and foremost, because, you know, we have 17 greens, and in some way, shape, or form, Foster touched darn near each one of them, right? Like, we knew we were going to be putting a grass on that was going to be faster than the previous turf that we had, going to be firmer. So we had to make some more cupping spaces in certain areas, even though, you know, I mean, you've obviously played the golf course. The most severe greens were rebuilt and they're not that severe. And then the other greens they're more subtle breaks, or they just, you know, can't one direction or the other.
Big broad slopes.
Yeah. So we had to go into those and just skim like an inch of top dressing off here or there to kind of make that a cuppable area post the renovation. And it's a pain to maintain. You know, it's like we don't have 18 identical soils underneath our greens that we know every day. I can kind of manage to say like 80-90%, and they're all similar in firmness, speed, all of that. We just have, you know, a hodgepodge of all different sorts of stuff. There's, in our opinion, and this even went through our committee, like there was no chance if we had stuck to our guns to rebuild the greens. There also was some improvements in technology since we did ours that would have helped on selling, rebuilding the greens that we didn't have access to. So that would be number one. I tell everybody the same thing. Like, I would never do one of these without rebuilding all the greens. The second is get your fairway turf in as fast as possible. A lot of our seeding on our fairways didn't occur until mid-September to mid-October. We ended up with a lot more POA back in the fairways than I would have liked. Certainly been an ongoing battle to try to get that percentage down. And then, you know, there's a host of different conversations that I have depending upon the level of what they're going to do. But, you know, what we did, I mean, we spent $2.5 million, right? And probably got $4 million worth of work out of that project in 2012. I mean, none of these projects go for less than like $6-8 million now. So, you know, we're kind of like, you know, the small fish, so to speak. Like, it's like, I wish I got to do that, you know, or, you know, heck yeah, I would, you know, if I had the $7 million budget for that, I would do that for sure. So, you know, a lot of them have kind of moved a level above our renovation. So it's not as, it's my phone fortunately doesn't ring as much as it used to, which is good.
good in one way, bad, you know. It's nice to talk to people every once in a while too.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, we still, don't get me wrong, we do that. I'm just saying, it was for a couple years, like, it was crazy. Like, you know, what grasses did you guys like? You know, what soils did you use? What bunker sands did you use? And, you know, all that stuff is so preferential to the golf course and the membership, right? Like what, you know, when we first did our bunkers, we did a sand called Elite Pro Angle, and it was 50% Pro Angle and a 50% byproduct called 1600. And it was, in comparison, like a loose sand, right? Your ball wouldn't necessarily fried egg, not to have any pun in this thing.
Brand.
But
we need more sand to give more fried eggs.
You need more fried egg lies. But it was difficult to spin the ball out of, right? So it was easy to just jam your club in it and get the ball to go flying out of the sand, but to actually, you know, the better player, it was a very difficult bunker to hit out of. They hated it. So 2 years in, we pulled it all out and went to just pure pro angle because, as I said before, we started getting a lot more low handicap players, and they like to be able to spin it. So they wanted the firmer sand. And honestly, it was quite the maintenance headache for us. I mean, we worked our tails off to try to make that Elite Pro Angle as good as we could, and it was just a difficult sand to work with, and we were on board with the change as well. But it was, let me tell you what, it was a lot more difficult bunker sand. If you hit it in the bunker, it was almost a virtual guaranteed bogey.
One might say that was better bunker sand.
I'm not, I don't want to.
You're not going to weigh in.
Well, yeah. As most people would tell you, I definitely have an opinion on everything. I would say that it was probably a little overkill. We went, as far as the amount of things we threw at our membership in one shot, that was maybe too much, right? Like they, you know, came in playing this parkland, tree-lined golf course, grass-faced bunkers, and suddenly we're throwing 120,000 square feet of bunkers sand at them, these intimidating faces, fescue. The bunkers were intended to have long eyebrows of fescue around them. And then we throw this, you know, ultra difficult bunker sand in the bunkers, and it was probably just a little bit too much. So,
you talking about the greens and rebuilding greens, I just had a quick question. Is what you're describing, you kind of have like 18 greens, each with their own unique personality that you have to deal with on a daily basis?
Correct.
Versus if you
and there will actually be areas within that green that are unique, right? So like our 10th green is a perfect example. The right side of it was too steep to put any cup. So Keith, literally, we went to the half point of the green, stripped all the sod off of it. Because when you're methyl bromiding, you traditionally don't tear the sod off. You just kill it and then beat the living, you know, bejesus out of it to get that mat down as low as you can, and then you just seed right into it. We wanted to be able to create some puttable areas on the right side of that green, so we had to core it about 5 inches down. So like the right half of that green has mix that is the exact mix that's in my 15th green that's total USGA spec. Whereas the left half is 80 years old of sand top dressing and aerification. So they totally react completely different. And to try to get the impact of a ball to match up, you know, between that right side and that left side is extremely difficult.
How do you try and do you apply more water?
Moisture management is like the best way. Yeah. Uh-huh. 100%.
And then you have like sensors that you're able to monitor that, or
use a handheld TDR probe.
That's so, a little thing that they,
purple thing that you see probably everywhere now. Guys walking around, they hit the button, and it gives you a volumetric, you know, water content reading. So, yeah,
it's a cool little device.
It has helped, and then in some instances it hurts. You know, I came up the old school, you pull a core and you see what the core looks like. Cause you know, you really have to water where the roots are. Like there's no point in watering where there's no grass roots. So if you take that probe and you're taking a 3.5 inch sample of the moisture, but you only have 1.5 inches of roots, you know, you're not really getting a valid reading to help you grow your grass. And you don't know that unless you're taking a core. You know, if you don't periodically pull a plug out of the green or something and see what your roots look like and things like that, you don't know exactly where you should be watering. So they're very good. I would never get rid of them, but you still have to go out there and manually look at what's underneath the turf.
we touched on it earlier, the fescue that you guys have. And I mean, it's absolutely stunning. I think that you hit on it, the texture and the color that it gives the golf course and the pop, and it really helps accentuate the property, I think, but also the playability of it. And, you know, you're not, I had a buddy in, who we used to play a lot of golf, and we would, he'd kind of a little bit more crooked than I am. And we'd go certain places. I'd say we're just gorse hunting all day, you know. I hate looking for golf balls. I hate it.
Same here.
I don't ask for help looking for my balls because I don't want people to ask me for help looking for theirs. But, you know, you've got your fescue where it looks great and it plays great, which I think the playing great is one of the most difficult things. Talk about management, and obviously you've had it now for almost 10 years, but what you've learned over the years maintaining that fescue grass that, you know, is now, seems to be everybody's trying to add it in to their.
Certainly the, you know, it's the popular thing these days for sure. We have learned a lot since we put it in. I would say we thought we knew some things when we put it in, and we probably have learned, you know, 20 times more now than what we did just researching it before we ever started. The number one issue is I would strip any of the areas that you're going to go in and you're going to put fescue in, because if you've been growing grass on those, you've got years and years of organic and fertilizer and everything built up in that system. And if all you do is go in and like round it up, scalp the grass down, punch holes, seed your fescue in there. I mean, fescue on fertilizer is nasty stuff. I mean, you can't find your ball, you can't hit out of it, nothing. Of course, that's how we did it, right? So it was for us, though.
I feel like that's how everybody learned.
I know. Well, in a little bit of our defense, we knew that would have been the better way to do it. We just couldn't afford it, you know, and we sort of felt like there were better things to spend our money on anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, nobody gets an unlimited budget. So you have to pick and choose what you still think are the best things that you're going to go spend your money on. Stripping all the fescue areas just wasn't, you know, in the cards for us. And at the time, 90% of it was supposed to be really out of play, right? So it was just more an accent. So who really cares if it's not that thin and wispy? You know, you're not supposed to hit your ball in there anyway. Well, some of it did start to, as we matured and more areas got brought in by, you know, Keith, we got some areas that they needed to be thin because you could definitely hit a ball in there for sure. And I would say it took us about 3 to 4 years to burn the organic and the old fertilizer out of those areas. And we're just now starting to hit where I feel like it's really good. Some things that we learned, we literally scalp the bejesus out of it every fall. We mow it like 3 times now, and I try to go about as low as our mowers will tolerate. So we go in there with the industrial zero turns, set them down to like 1.75 inches. Not the first time. You got to kind of hack the stalks off and clean that. You know, we vac that up, take any organic material out of it because anything breaking down will add to that nitrogen system. So then the next hack, we get it down to about 3 inches. And then end of the season, we go like scalp level, and then we scalp it again in the spring. I mean, we're talking chunks of grass flying out of the thing, right? Like, I mean, we're just trying to literally pull plant material out, and then we send a vacuum in and we vac that stuff all up. That's helped us a ton, and for a couple reasons. One, thinning the plant out when we go in with our sprays, you can really get better penetration of your pre-emergence, your herbicides, things like that.
It doesn't sit on the grass.
Correct. Yeah. You know, technically a lot of these, like the pre-emergence, should really get some level of water to get them down in and create that good barrier. Well, I mean, the last thing you want to do is turn any water on in those areas. So you're trying to keep them as dry as you possibly can. The better you can go in with like a good water volume on your spray, get the penetration, because the canopy is just not as thick. In the last 2 seasons, we've seen just an immense improvement in weed control. they brought out a couple new herbicides that have kind of helped. And really, we're now down to our biggest issue is just controlling some quack grass in some areas. That's the nastiest weed that we deal with, without question. Yeah, and if a native section gets taken over by quack grass, you might as well just kill it and start over, because it you can't find your ball in it, you can't play out of it. It's terrible. It's a terrible scenario to have in your native.
I mean, and for the golfer, I mean, you look at some of these and it's such like an ocean of grass. You know, how do you know when quack? How do you monitor that stuff? Like, do you walk through it? Do you have somebody walk through it? Or is that like, how do you know?
It's pretty easy for us to spot quack grass.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I showed it to you once, you would be able to spot quack grass. You know?
I've got this weed problem at my house. It's pokeweed. 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 And it's driving me insane.
How did you identify that, by the way?
What?
How did you identify that, by the way?
Plant snap. I took a
picture. Does that actually tell you how to kill it?
No. Well, then I just started pulling it out.
That's not good, then. Who cares?
I have to dig it out.
You got to dig it out?
It's got these big roots. If I just pull it out, it just like regrows.
Pokeweed. I got to be honest with you. I'm going to have to look that one up, because I can't say that my weed knowledge is up to that level of snuff. Pokeweed.
Holes in our like mulch beds all the time. Digging these big, they look like carrot roots when you pull them out.
Really?
Oh, it's awful. I know when I get home, there's going to be like five more of them have grown up. Grow up out of nowhere. It just drives me crazy.
I'm gonna figure out a game plan for you. I'll let you know how you get rid of pokeweed that you don't have to dig it up.
Well, my wife doesn't let me use fertile. Doesn't let me spray anything.
Anything?
No.
Then I would just let the pokeweed grow.
Well, it drives me crazy.
If we're all natural, then whatever grows in there grows in there. Sorry, honey.
Well, it would drive me crazy. So you play a lot of golf in the winter.
Yep.
What have been your favorite trips? And maybe what's been a trip that opened your eyes to something about golf that you didn't really appreciate before?
So, you know, I would say, to start at the back end of your question, when I first got here as the superintendent, there was a group of guys that would always go in September, and they would play Marion Golf Club. And like around about my second or third year here, they invited me to go. And it was like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So you get three rounds of golf at Marion Golf Club, right? And, you know, to that point, I was just some, you know, stupid, you know, dumb kid. I'd done, you know, some internships, worked on golf courses, things like that. And you're like, oh yeah, you know, you think you know a lot. And then you get to go to a place like that, right? And you just see the history. And I mean, it's just, it's still an amazing place to me. And I haven't seen it in a few years. Love to go back and see it after the renovation. But I feel like that left a lasting impression on me to show, like, this is what some great architecture, you know, can look like. And it doesn't require to be on like a huge piece of land and you know, have trees all over the place and things like that. So I feel like that was a pretty eye-opening experience, and told me that, hey, I want to get around and see a whole lot more. There's obviously like a lot of things to see in the world, and not just in Detroit, right? 100%, way too many. So I feel like that started it, right? And it also caused me to fall in love with East Coast golf. Like I've certainly played a lot of golf, probably in about every place that they would say are the best of the best, with the exception of the Sand Belt in Australia. And I still feel like that's the greatest concentration of awesome golf there is. To give you the best example, I had a trip there once in the fall, and we played Garden City Men's Club, National, Shinnecock, the Country Club, Eastward Ho, and then we got one whole day on Fisher's Island, like sun up to sundown. And hands down, greatest golf trip I've ever been on. I mean, it was just awesome. You know, it's one of those things where like the weather was perfect every day. The company was awesome. The people we met. I mean, it was a trip of a lifetime. Right. And to see those just back to back to back to back. Right. And just study kind of, you know, what, you know, how did they intend these golf courses to be played? You know, how the guys are maintaining them. It was special, right? I just love it out east. Like I just think it's the best of the best. I end up in Florida a lot, Arizona, California, because of the winter.
You're playing in the winter.
Yeah, and so, you know, not to disrespect anybody on your podcast, but it's like there's not a ton of like great I mean, you don't go to Florida to study architecture, right?
No.
I mean, Seminole is awesome. You certainly could go there and study the greens and angles and things like that, 100%. But I mean, that's so rare in Florida, right? I mean, that one and like Mountain Lake are my two favorites in Florida. And you definitely can learn some things there. But, you know, the rest of them, you just, you know, they're fun to play.
It's nice.
Hybrid
weather.
Bermuda greens are awesome to putt on.
Yeah.
The weather's stellar. And you're not here in the snow. So that's all great, but I do it more just to recharge the batteries and stop thinking about, you know, what kind of summer we got coming up for us and so on and so forth. So
when do you start thinking about summer?
I mean, I'd love to tell you that you never, that you actually do stop thinking about the summer, but, you know, you probably get about a good 6 weeks really where you're not thinking about some level of grass. You know, it does get annoying. I've got to be honest with you at times. Like, you're just like, God, I got to get that out of my head. So you get about 6 weeks of break where, you know, you can recharge and you're like, I'm ready to go for next season. And
when's the date that you like feel like you're in the home stretch of like where you don't have like the big problems of summer?
So there was an old superintendent here that was around for probably like 40 years, right? And I'm not going to say his name because then he'd just like really think he's the top dog. But anyway, it was always August 14th. Sorry. August 14th was always the, you really can't kill any grass after that day. It doesn't matter how bad the summer is. Like August 14th was that cutoff date. And I'll be honest with you, he's been pretty accurate. Like once you hit that, you know, the days are so short that even if you have some turf that's a little stressed, like aeration's right around the corner, you know, some lower humidities, things like that. I mean, life starts to get pretty good by the end of August. So.
National Midwest Superintendent's Day, August 14th.
Yeah, exactly. August 14th. Now, there are some issues with that, though, too. Like we have our men's club championship is after that. And if you get rain, it's hard to drive the golf course out in that period of time, right? Because the days are so much shorter. So it can have an effect on the playability.
That.
But it from my life of actually killing grass, it's a lot better. But yeah, you definitely struggle to drive the golf course out better in late August because of the short days and sun angles are, you know, vanishing in a hurry.
Yeah, I never thought about how it makes complete sense, like why rain affects golf courses in terms of firmness so much more in the spring and the fall is just because of the length of the days.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, your top time to really, at least here in the Midwest for us, I'm sure the East Coast guys are pretty similar. Best chance you have of providing the best conditions is the month of June. You got the longest days, even when it's hot, it's typically the humidity is lower. And you can really crank on it. I mean, you can get some fairways that are just bouncing like crazy, and yeah, that's your month. Like that, and I would assume that's probably why the U.S. Open is in June, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. Although now we're obviously moving it all over the place, but I mean, I'm thinking back in the day when they chose sites probably based on something like that.
You went through the financial crisis, and you went through this. How have they been different for your job?
What's this?
Coronavirus.
Oh, the coronavirus. Yeah. Boy, that's an interesting question for sure. I sort of feel like I've, you know, even though, you know, I was still I don't know, not that old when the financial crisis happened. I'd been through like good and bad economic times, right? Like even growing up, and you kind of recognize, I mean, you know, it's you know, you read things, people getting laid off, stuff like that, right? So I mean I had a history to say that lasts a little while and then we pop back, right? So it was bad in 2008, and certainly some things happened to people that you wouldn't have probably expected, but I still feel like it was something that I had a known, you know, history with. This thing is just, this is like the craziest thing I've ever had to live through. I mean, never in my life did I think that we would all have to be, you know, shut in our houses. Although, you know, we still had to mow the grass, so we technically weren't shut in the house other than when you got home. I mean, you couldn't go have dinner or anything like that. But I feel like there were a lot more uncertainties. Yeah. And then it's the era of Twitter and Facebook and, you know, 24-hour news cycles, and, you know, people just watch and get on too much of this crap, you know. I mean, I realize that this is, you know, that Instagram and Twitter, you know, help put food on the table for you. But
I have to get myself off there. You just get on there and you start reading. I've noticed especially when the weather wasn't good. I mean, I'm sitting in my basement and I'm just reading, and it's just like you just get yourself into this spot where it's like, God, I think that's why we're seeing unparalleled demand and popularity of golf, is it's so nice to have something that gets you away from all your screens and away like from the world for a little while.
I think that's what helped us, as far as I'm sure most superintendents would probably tell you that. Like, if I had been stuck just confined to my house, I think I would have gone crazy. So the fact that we could, you know, get outside, even though the weather wasn't very nice for us while we were in shutdown here, you didn't focus on that stuff. Like, I didn't have time to see, you know, what they were saying on, you know, the news or Twitter or Facebook or things like this. So, you know, to us, the first like week was the strangest thing I've ever experienced. I mean, to be out here working, have no noise, no traffic, literally this road here, you know, you could walk across and not even look. It was like the zombie apocalypse, so to speak. And that aspect was really strange. But once we got into our flow and started understanding, you know, what we had to get done every day, it was way more helpful than being confined to your house and just sitting there and just staring at, you know, what was just horrible news every day, right? I mean, hour by hour, it's like, man, this is just terrible. Even so, we worked 7 days a week, but on the weekends it was a lot less. In March and April, the weather wasn't stressful for us. So, I mean, if I went home to even turn the news on for like 10 minutes, it was like, oh my God, like I couldn't do it. Like, I just literally couldn't do it. So I would not watch that. I would maybe watch a Netflix of something, you know, that ilk. But I kept up enough so that I knew what we were supposed to be doing, our precautions that we were supposed to be taking with our staff and things like that. But beyond that, I couldn't sit there and like watch Andrew Cuomo give a friggin', you know, update every day like that. No way. I don't want to watch anybody do that. Right? Yeah. I don't care what the subject is. Like, if I got to watch somebody do the same thing every single day, no, doesn't work for me.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I think that's like diversions were the best, and being outside, and you were probably short staffed, so you had more work than ever before. So that's the other thing, you know, work is a great diversion regardless.
It is. And certainly when you have, you know, 8 people on 150 acres, I mean, you know, every day I'd be looking around and go, we're not getting a damn thing done. Like, what's the problem? And then I'd look around and go, yeah, it's a big place for 8 people to try to take care of. I mean, it was an interesting stretch. So I feel like, you know, that's the difference, is that this was just totally uncharted territory. Whereas the financial collapse, it just was a little more knowledgeable history to having gone through recessions before and things like that. So,
Well, I appreciate the time, and everybody that gets a chance to come see your spot, it's a special place. It's one of the best in Detroit, one of the best in the Midwest, and people can find you on Twitter. You're on Twitter.
Yeah, they can find me on Twitter. I don't really say much, you know. Yeah. You can get in too much trouble these days by saying
they can,
anything.
They can talk to you, though.
They can talk to me.
They can at you.
They can at me for sure. Yes. Yep. I'll respond 100%. But I appreciate that. Yeah. It's a fun place. It's been a great place to work for the last 20 odd years. And, you know, hopefully we got some more fun things coming.